Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate. Kia ora and welcome back to our Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Epsom. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, the Mercy Sisters, our programs, or about social justice. Today, my visitor is Bill Kilgallen. Bill, a warm welcome to our radio program.
Thank you.
Bill is the head of the National Office for Professional Standards in New Zealand. Bill is from England and moved to New Zealand about 4 years ago. He had a long career in social work and healthcare. In 1971, he founded the St. Anne's Community Services, to which he stayed CEO for 24 years. St. Anne's works with the people who are homeless, people with alcohol and drug problems, people with learning disabilities, and people with mental health problems. It provides a wide range of housing and social care services across Yorkshire and the northeast of England. Among many other activities, Bill served on a number of government advisory bodies in England. He was chief executive of St. Gemma's Hospice in Leeds, and he was councillor of the Leeds City Council. In 2008, he became the chair of the National Catholic Safeguarding Commission in England. Bill, you have had a great career, and you were involved in social justice issues in England. And if I understand it right, you came to New Zealand to retire. What made you take up the position as head of the National Office for Professional Standards in New Zealand?
It was by chance, really, that I met people in Auckland, and they discovered in talking to me what I'd done in England and asked me if I would get involved in the work of tackling abuse in the Catholic Church in New Zealand. And just at about that time, the then director of the Professional Standards Office for the Catholic Church was retiring. Mm-hmm. And he was an excellent man, a man called John Jemison, who'd been the Commissioner of Police for New Zealand and was very active in the Baptist Church. And when the National Office was established, he was the first person appointed director. So I took over from him.
So you just happened to hear about it, that he was retiring and they needed somebody else. And
yes.
Somebody said, oh, Bill has this background from England.
Yeah, so I applied for the job and went through a normal selection process. And
so now you're the head of the National Office for Professional Standards in New Zealand.
Yeah.
A long name. Can you tell us more about this office?
Yes, we're established to oversee all complaints of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church in New Zealand, and to make sure that the people who make the complaints are listened to, that their complaints are then investigated, and that there's a proper resolution to them. Now, obviously, we don't do all the detailed work. That's done locally in the different dioceses in New Zealand. But we have the job of making sure that it's done properly, and also the task of trying to prevent abuse happening again in the church.
So you're one centre, one office in Auckland?
Yes.
But you deal with cases from all
New Zealand, yeah.
The title of your office may sound like a euphemism. In England, you were often called the safeguarding watchdog, or the one who introduced new house cleaning benchmarks for the Catholic Church. These titles express certainly well of how people were seeing you. When you are asked here in New Zealand about your job and you say that you are the head of the National Office for Professional Standards in New Zealand, do people understand it?
No, but I explain very clearly and openly that it's an office set up to deal with abuse within the Catholic Church. Professional standards is a term that's used across the board, really. The police have a Department of Professional Standards, the Law Society, lots of other professions have a title the same. In England, there's a word used that's only just becoming used in New Zealand, which is safeguarding.
Mm-hmm.
And that's intended to convey more than child protection or vulnerable adult protection, but more to give the notion that it's a more holistic service where you're looking at all the activities of your organisation and making sure that they support and welcome children and other people and don't ever damage them.
So there's more focus on the prevention rather than on healing.
Yeah, it's both prevention and then when things have gone wrong, on sorting it out.
Mm-hmm. For those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Epsom. We are on air every Friday morning at 8:40 a.m. on Planet FM 104.6. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk or send me an email at muffintalk840@gmail.com. My visitor today is Bill Kilgallen. Bill works at the National Office of Standards for the Catholic Church in New Zealand. He told us about how he came to work for this national office in New Zealand and what the tasks of this office were. Bill, the other day when you were speaking about risk management in parishes, you said that the biggest risk were people. Why did you say so?
I've spent my life working in providing healthcare and social care services. And in all our organisations, when we look at risk, there are risks that your building might be unsafe or other things. But the biggest risk in all these settings are that you choose the wrong people to work there, or that you don't train people well enough, or that people make mistakes which were avoidable if they'd been trained properly or screened properly. And so for any organisation that's primarily about people, if they're looking to see where is there a risk of harm, they need to look at their people first. And that means that you must be very careful about who you involve. So if you're selecting people to be priests or teachers or police officers or anybody in a position of trust, you first of all need to make sure that they are trustworthy.
And
it sounds obvious.
How do you make sure that they are trustworthy?
Well, you would do the simple things like screening them, checking whether they've got any criminal convictions. You would get references and talk to people who they've worked with, because the past behaviour is the best predictor of future behaviour. And so it's very important to know who you're taking on.
What about people who are already on board?
Well, if there haven't been screening checks before, then you introduce them and explain them to people.
Mm-hmm.
And start as you mean to go on. And I think my experience is that people welcome that. At first they think, why on earth are you checking on me? I've been doing this job for years.
Yeah.
But when they understand the need to check everybody, they see it as a valuing of them. For example, I ran a hospice in Leeds, my last job there, and we had more than 200 staff, but we had 600 volunteers. And all those volunteers went through a checking process, including whether they had a criminal record, including getting references, and they had training. They all accepted that and valued it.
Mm-hmm.
One of them said to me, it shows that we're important enough, that you put training in, you value what we're doing, and therefore you make sure we're suitable to do it, you train us to do it, and you provide some support when we're doing it. And that's how we should be with volunteers.
Have you started introducing that in New Zealand, or is it introduced already?
No, it's in preparation. The requirement to do that was introduced, but there was never a training program. So we, this year, appointed somebody to develop a training program, which she's doing at the moment, and then we will roll that out over the coming months throughout New Zealand.
That will be for all parishes and all dioceses?
Yes.
It was focusing on parish work or school work? Or?
No, it will be focusing on the parishes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the schools already have a system for vetting their staff and people who go into schools. That's a system that's already in place. What we don't have is a good system in the parishes yet. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to be looking at.
That's why we had one of these talks about risk management. The abuse scandals that you were mentioning also have been in the news for quite some time. However, the cases we hear about are often about incidents that happened 40 or 50 years ago. Why are the accusations raised only now?
We deal with quite a number of people who come to see us because they were abused as children by somebody in a position of trust. Most sexual abuse of children happens within families. It's most often a relative, and the next most often is somebody in a position of trust. It's very rarely a stranger. And we're dealing with people who are in a position of trust, either they were clergy or religious, members of religious orders. And the damage to children, young children, of being abused by a relative or a person in a position of trust is very, very severe, very often. And many people can't speak about it for a long time afterwards. And that varies from individual to individual. I've dealt with people who it's taken them 50 or 60 years.
60 years?
To come forward and talk about it. And this thing has nagged with them throughout their life. In many cases, it's destroyed their ability to make relationships. They've had a very difficult, when they've tried to live as a family themselves, they've found it difficult. They've often, some of the most desperate have committed suicide. So the impact on individuals is often quite severe. Not on everybody, but on many, many people. And different things trigger off the disclosure of this abuse. It could be that they see something in the paper about the school they were at. It could be that they're invited to a reunion for people who went to a particular children's home or school, and they said, my God, I couldn't go back there. This is what happened to me. And they then think they should do something about it. It could be something that's happened in the family. Sometimes it's prompted by, we've had, for example, a number of people who now live in Australia but were brought up in New Zealand, and there's a Royal Commission in Australia looking into abuse in all institutions in Australia, doing a tremendous job. That's encouraged some people to come forward to us.
Do you think that if these people, like you said, 60 years ago, do you think that if that person had been heard 50 years ago or 55 years ago, he would have had a better life?
Yes. Yeah. There's no doubt about it, that the earlier people get help and get listened to, the better the outcomes will be. But when you're looking back, there was a period where people didn't believe it happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've dealt with people who told their parents, and the parents didn't believe it. They said, oh no, a priest or a teacher wouldn't have done that to you. And of course that means that the trust between the child and the parents is destroyed. Because if your parents won't believe you, what's the point in telling anybody else?
Yeah.
They're not likely to. And so people's experience was that they would be unlikely to be listened to. They wouldn't be heard. And therefore, this thing was bottled up inside them. And our job is to listen to that.
Yes.
And then, when we've heard that, to investigate it, to take it seriously, to look at it. If the person who committing the abuse is still alive and around, we encourage that individual, if it's a matter that's criminal offence, and it mostly is, to go to the police. Because the police are the best people to investigate abuse. I mean, they come into it.
Yeah, that's the investigation part.
Yeah. With no agenda to protect the church or anybody else. So, but many of the people who come to us don't want to do that. They feel it would be much more public.
And the wounds will come up again.
Yeah. And also, sometimes the people who committed the offences against them are dead. Yeah. And so the police can't investigate if the offender's dead.
And when an accusation is raised, how do you go about it and research without prejudging?
Well, we'd never prejudge, but what we'd do is listen very carefully to what's said. And then we have somebody investigate it. We have a group, and that investigation is then reported to a group of people, one covering the north of the country, one in the south, and that's a mixture of people with legal experience, psychology, health, investigation experience, so people with directly relevant experience who can bring an independent view, bring a real independent view to it, and make a recommendation then to the bishop or the head of the religious order about what decision should be made. And very often the most important thing for people who have been abused is that they're heard, they're listened to and believed.
Taken seriously.
Yeah. And for some of them then they will need some counselling or some support, and then it's up to the church to provide that, either to fund it or provide it, and see what other ways we can assist the individual.
So you assist the individual without taking sides or anything. You're listening to the individual and you help the person, if the offender is still alive, to go to the police and to report there and leave the investigation to the police. And if the offender is already dead, then...
We would investigate.
You would investigate.
Or if the individual doesn't want to go to the police, then we will have the matter investigated.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people who do that. And because that's really important, that we check it and make sure we identify the right person, because we're dealing with matters many years ago and very often things that happen to children, and so it's important both for them and for the church that we get it right.
Oh yes, because
it's important for them, because they want to understand what happened to them, why it happened. And most importantly, what we have to say to people is to remember that at the time they were a child, the other person was the adult. The blame and the shame lies with the adult. But all too often, the individual who's been abused ends up feeling blame and shame. And part of our task is to help them move that to where it should belong, with the abuser.
And when you talk about abuse, we often think about only physical or sexual abuse, and you were also mentioning sexual abuse. But what about psychological and emotional abuse? Do you also deal with these kind of issues?
No, we don't. Our remit is very firmly on the sexual abuse issues. I think that would be... That's not to deny that there can't be psychological and emotional abuse, but that's outside our remit presently.
Okay, and we have heard about what you do once an accusation is raised, and how do you prevent abuse? Because you said you were helping the person to talk about it, but the best thing is always prevention.
Yes. I think there are a number of stages in prevention. One is, in an organisation like the church, is making sure that only people who are suitable are chosen to become priests or teachers or members of religious orders. So, I mean, there is a much more effective screening these days than there was 30 or 40 years ago. Much more psychological profiling and testing, and much more rigorous investigation of people's past. And that's really important. There's also a very important role for training people properly. Now, this is not only to prevent abuse, but also to recognise it. Because the church will be, in most congregations in the church, there will be somebody who's been abused. Most likely somebody who's been abused in their family. And the church should be a place of welcome and healing for all people, and they should be able to find in the church a place where they might get help. And so it's important that those who are working in the church are trained to recognise and respond properly to people who come forward to them and say, look, this is what's going, I'm going through at the moment, or this is what has happened to me, how can I get help, so that the church will be able to point them in the right direction to get help and assistance at the time they need it.
Do you also help then the priests in case somebody says something during reconciliation and the priest cannot talk, but he might have other ways to help the
person? Yes, a person who's been abused, resigning the priest, that's what we want to do, is make sure that priests are trained well enough to be able to give them the advice of where to go for help.
Mm-hmm. And what do you recommend to parishioners who would like to have a safe parish? It's to be aware, like you said, that people know where to go. But a parish where, what can everybody do so that that everyone feels safe in the church? There must be something that we can all contribute.
Well, I think the church relies on voluntary effort. It couldn't run without people who volunteer to do jobs. And I think the best thing a parish can do is to welcome the opportunity to make sure that volunteers who are working with children or with other people who are vulnerable, for example, older people living in their own homes who rely on the church or another organisation for visits and help, that the church should know enough about how to protect those children and those older people in that vulnerable situation, and so expect that people are trained and help to do that properly. And also that within the church, what we want to build is a source of advice so that if parishioners or a volunteer in a parish is concerned about somebody or a child says something to them, you know, it might only happen once in a lifetime, but they need to know that there is somebody that they can trust to talk, and that volunteer can ring somebody and say, this is what's happened, what should I do, and get the right advice. So that's what we're hoping to build up in every parish, that very positive approach that we are here for children, for people who are vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And on the 7th of July this year, Pope Francis was celebrating a mass for a group of clergy sex abuse victims. In his homily, Pope Francis said, quote, "For some time now, I have felt in my heart deep pain and suffering, so much time hidden, camouflaged with a complicity that cannot be explained until someone realized that Jesus was looking and others the same, and they set about to sustain that gaze." Maybe we should stick with your English compatriots who talk about your work as new house cleaning of the church. This seems to be the hope of so many Catholics, isn't it?
I think that homily by Pope Francis was probably one of the best short summaries of what the church should be doing. He was so clear about the impact of abuse on victims. He was absolutely clear on what he sees as the key responsibility of bishops and others in leadership in the church to make sure that victims are listened to and that prevention strategies are put in place. And he really does understand this. And that's one of the other reasons that quite a number of people have come forward this year, because they've seen the example from Pope Francis, and as one of them said to me recently, he sounds like a man who means what he says.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a great leadership from him.
Yeah. Because that shows trust. People have trust in him.
Yeah.
And that's the first part, and especially for those who don't think that they can trust anybody.
Yeah.
If they hear these words, they might think about going to your office, for example, and telling them what they have experienced. And can you give me a positive example? I'd like to have a positive example. It doesn't have to be limited to New Zealand, of how you were able to help someone and this person was particularly happy about the support or existence of the Offices of Professional Standards of the Catholic Church.
Well, I think the example I would give you is a woman from Ireland. And I can name her because she's made her name public, and she's called Marie Collins. And when she was 13, she was abused. She was a hospital patient, inpatient, and she was abused by the priest who was the chaplain in the hospital. Mm. And this had a very damaging effect on her, destroyed her life in many ways. And Later in life, she built up the courage to go and talk about it and reported it. And at that time, the church authorities merely moved the man somewhere else, and he carried on abusing. And she found this very difficult. She then was listened to, not by the church, as it happens, but by the health board, whose hospital she'd been in. And they helped her to start the process of recovery. She'd married, she had a child, she had mental health difficulties, and she started to rebuild her life. And she founded a group of four people who'd been abused and did tremendous work with them. And she is now a very powerful speaker about abuse and has helped countless people through her willingness to speak. And she's now on an international commission that was set up by Pope Francis. And she's one of the members of that commission that's guiding the church's response to abuse in the future. And she's a tremendous person to meet, and a real example, I think, of somebody who went through hell and has come through and doesn't just recover for herself, but recovers to ensure that other people survive and turn from victims into survivors.
She gives a good example.
Yeah, that's
great.
She's brilliant.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
It has been a pleasure to have you here. And to our listeners, if there are some upcoming events in our Mercy Spirituality Center, to which I'd like to draw your attention, on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, from 7 to 9 p.m., there's an Advent retreat with Sister Helen Bergen with the topic, God is Always Coming. Come and this time, take this time to reflect and for prayer. And Sister Helen Bergen will be my next interview guest next Friday. And if you'd like to register for her retreat, please call us at Auckland 638-6238. And a special event in 2015 will be a retreat day with Edwina Gately. Edwina Gately is from the United States, and she will share stories and poetry on the topic, Mothers, Sisters, Daughters, Standing on Their Shoulders. If you book in before New Year, you will have a special early bird fee for you. So, and if you have any need for discernment or find out what you can do, you may consider spending some time at our Mercy Spirituality Center. We offer retreats, Christian meditation, and spiritual companioning, but we also have a very interesting program which you can access through our website, www.mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. And for any feedback on my interviews, please contact me at muffintalk840@gmail.com. And I wish you all a good week ahead, and hope that you tune in next Friday again. Have a blessed day.